This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Thursday, August 27th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker.
Four more years!
Now, if you want to really drive him crazy, you say 12 more years. Because we caught them doing some really bad things in 2016. Let's see what happens. We caught them doing some really bad things.
On Monday, the Republican National Convention kicked off in Charlotte, North Carolina. Despite nearly 4 years of scandal, a presidential impeachment, a world-changing pandemic, and a nationwide cultural reckoning on race, Trump's message to voters remains almost identical to what we heard during the 2016 campaign. He is the only thing standing between the American people and the Washington elites, crime and violence in the cities, and foreign powers that want to destroy us.
So I just want to thank everybody for this incredible support. Be very, very careful. This is going to be, and I really believe this, this is the most important election in the history of our country.
Yeah, it is.
Don't let them take it away from you. Don't let them take it away. North Carolina, we love you.
Trump's rhetoric has proved to be extraordinarily durable. Although Joe Biden continues to lead in the polls, in recent weeks, the margin has narrowed. Peter Slevin, a New Yorker contributing writer, joins me to discuss Trump's solid popularity among Republicans and the power of his appeals to nostalgia, fear, and anger. Peter, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Dorothy.
So you're a professor of journalism as well as a working journalist. And over the past year, we've heard endlessly from the mainstream media that the rhetoric of the Trump campaign is engineered to appeal to Trump's base and that Trumpism has alienated moderate members of the party. And that seemed borne out at the Democratic convention last week when John Kasich and Colin Powell backed Joe Biden. But Trump's poll numbers are as strong as ever with Republicans. Do you think that Democrats and never-Trumpers are making the same mistake they made in 2016, underestimating Trump's strengths?
I think 2016 was a wake-up call to everyone, never to underestimate Donald Trump and the power of his rhetoric. His numbers among Republicans have been remarkably steady. They do seem to be declining just a little bit in recent polls. But it's also worth remembering that only 29% of Americans in states that require registration by party, in fact, are Republicans. There are more independents registered in this country than Republicans. And so his base does seem to be strong. He is appealing to his base, but he's going to need an awful lot more than that to win in November.
And did you see any of that so far at the convention, that broadening the appeal?
It's striking just how hard they're hitting on those themes, as you said, from 2016, what he called American carnage in his inaugural address. He does clearly need to reach out to moderates, and every poll shows that he's losing strength among Republican women, especially in the suburbs, and he's losing strength among voters over 65 who were bothered by his response to the pandemic. You'd think that they might go a little further in trying to reach out to these voters. He does need to put together a coalition than he seems to be doing in these first few days.
It's striking, don't you think, how the party has showcased the subject of diversity. So we saw Trump perform a naturalization ceremony at the White House on Tuesday evening. Speakers have been talking about Trump's contributions to communities of color. And former South Carolina governor and former U.N. ambassador Nikki Haley had this to say.
In much of the Democratic Party, it's now fashionable to say that America is racist. That is a lie. America is not a racist country. This is personal for me. I am the proud.
She then mentioned the discrimination and hardship, as she put it, that her Indian American family has faced, but we'll set that aside for the moment. What is the strategic thinking here?
Well, you know, I think these all conventions are a bit of a buffet. You pick and choose a little bit of from each thing that you actually want if you're the audience. And the fact is, Trump does need to find more voters than his Republican base. He has made an effort, including in Milwaukee, to set up offices in Black communities in hopes of peeling away some Black voters. And I think Haley's speech, or at least the part of the speech you're talking about, was meant to say, you know, we're not all that bad. As Republicans, we are more diverse than you might think of us as being. And trust us, we're really all about bringing the country together, which she said, obviously it is belied by Trump's almost daily tweets.
She's also considered one of the voices of the party's future. What did you think of the speech overall, given that her ambitions?
It was clearly a speech that was pitched not just to Trump voters this time around, but surely to the Republican Party in 2024, should she try to run that year. She talked about herself. She talked about South Carolina and what she had done there. She sure made it up in terms of foreign policy. It was an alternate reality, as far as I'm concerned, when she was talking about how Trump has conducted foreign policy and where that has left the United States. There was a lot of, I think, boilerplate Republican speechifying. It sounded actually to me like Mitt Romney in 2012 running against Barack Obama.
Interesting. So less of the Trumpism and more going back to a more moderate Republicanism.
Well, I would say that she was talking about, you know, when she says that Joe Biden is a socialist danger, that's what Romney said about Barack Obama. It's a message that the Republicans are trying desperately to make stick against Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. And that'll be, I think, one of the big questions of the next couple of months. Can they portray successfully Biden and Harris as being on the far left or, as Nikki Haley said, in thrall to, you know, Bernie Sanders and, as she referred to them, the squad?
Yeah, we'll get back to that in a second. I also wanted to ask you about the so-called regular people the convention has featured, including probably most notably Mark and Patricia McCloskey, who became known for pointing guns at Black Lives Matter protesters who marched past their home in St. Louis. At the convention, they were nicely dressed. Their hands were neatly folded in their laps. They were the image of the suburban voters you mentioned earlier that the party hopes to either keep in its camp this year or win over.
What you saw happen to us could just as easily happen to any of you who are watching from quiet neighborhoods around our country. And that's what we want to speak to you about tonight.
That's exactly right. Whether it's the defunding of police, ending cash bail so criminals can be released back out on the streets the same day to riot again, or encouraging anarchy and chaos on our streets, it seems as if the Democrats no longer view the government's job as protecting honest citizens from criminals, but rather protecting criminals from honest citizens.
You are based, Peter, in Chicago. You've been traveling across the U.S. covering the campaign. How is this message resonating?
There's no question that this is a strong card for the Republicans and for Trump to play. I mean, the notion that these folks are regular Americans is a bit far-fetched, given that they live in a mansion and they were brandishing these weapons against peaceful protesters. The videos make that very clear. But you're right. The effort is to suggest that the mayhem we're seeing sporadically, we need to say, in a very few American cities could spread to the suburbs. Donald Trump needs to do something to scare Republicans and independents back into his corner this time around, or to attract them with some kind of message that they're going to be better off if he wins four more years. So far, what he's doing is a very Nixonian 1968, be very afraid.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
In June, you reported on the surprising victory of 24-year-old Madison Cawthorn in a Republican runoff election in Mark Meadows' former House district in North Carolina. And Cawthorn spoke on Wednesday night at the convention.
I just turned 25. When I'm elected this November, I'll be the youngest member of Congress in over 200 years. And if you don't think young people can change the world, then you just don't know American history. George Washington was 21 when he received his first military commission. Abe Lincoln, 22 when he first ran for office. And my personal favorite, James Madison, was just 25 years old when he signed the Declaration of Independence. In times of peril, young people have stepped up and saved this country, abroad and at home.
Both Meadows, who is now Trump's chief of staff, and Trump had supported a family friend of Meadows for the seat, but Cawthorn was quickly chosen to speak at the convention. And I wonder what you think that tells us about the future of Trumpism in the Republican Party.
Well, Madison Cawthorn is one very talented young politician. He has charisma. He speaks smoothly and, it would seem to his base, thoughtfully. But he's also about as far right as one can be. He is telegenic, and his message clearly was designed to attract young voters to the party with this notion of sort of uplift and inspiration. I went to a rally of his in Hendersonville, North Carolina, in the summer, and his message was far darker than anything he suggested last night at the convention. He mocked the Democratic governor of North Carolina for closing down the state because of COVID, saying it was politically motivated. He was very critical of, as he put it, women, and especially minority women who are single mothers, who have more kids so that they can get more welfare payments. In many ways, he's a throwback to sort of Reagan-era Republicans, and he talks a much darker message in his district than he certainly did on stage in front of all those American flags.
So the protests we've been seeing this summer continue over police shootings, and the convention's been taking place against the shooting of Jacob Blake, a 29-year-old black man, by police officers in Kenosha, Wisconsin. And these protests, like those across the rest of the country, have been largely peaceful. But on Tuesday night, three protesters were shot, two of them fatally. And a 17-year-old, Kyle Rittenhouse, has been arrested in connection to the deaths and has been linked to right-wing militias and previous Trump rallies. Talk a little bit about that, the theme of protests, how the police shootings and the protesters fit into the Trump campaign and the message they are broadcasting.
You know, it seems to me Donald Trump is playing the hand he's got. He can't talk about COVID because that has gone badly. He can't talk about the economy because that has gone badly. He can't talk about how he has replaced the Affordable Care Act. What he's got right now is, as he likes to say in all caps, law and order. And the protests, most recently in Kenosha, just up the road from Chicago, very much play into his narrative that the cities are awash with anger and hate and violence. And you'll hear, we have heard throughout the convention, this notion that, boy, under Joe Biden, things would be ever worse. These Democratic mayors have lost control. You need me. You got to trust me to fix things. It's very much the American carnage message.
Yes, and he did announce that he would be sending federal law enforcement into Kenosha to restore law and order, as he did out in Portland, which didn't go entirely as he had hoped it would.
He did say that, yes. And last night, at least, the protests in Kenosha were quite peaceful.
Twitter is Trump's most effective weapon, I think it's safe to say. And you, I know, have been closely following his feed. Could you talk a little bit about that and how representative that is of what's been playing out?
Yeah, it's entertaining, I guess. Is that the word to watch Trump on Twitter, but also maddening? And if you combine Trump's Twitter feed with the Trump campaign's daily email barrage, you get a message of venom and of victimization. You'd think they were at the Alamo, outnumbered, not the ones who are actually in charge of the country and pretty much holding all the levers of power.
The mainstream media does talk a lot about fear and how Trump stokes fears and how effective that is. But we probably should point out that Joe Biden, who accepted his nomination last week with a speech all about love and unity, his campaign hasn't been averse to stoking fears either about the dangers Trump poses to American democracy. You know, whatever you think about that, he has been making that message very clear. One assumes it's mostly a tactic to fire up his own base. But how are Republicans responding to this apocalyptic view of what might await us with a second term of Donald Trump?
Well, we know from many Trump supporters that they're all in on this notion that the mainstream media, the liberal elites, all of these assailants are out to get them. The real question is whether that's going to be enough to reelect Donald Trump. I was in South Dakota the other day, and I stopped by a store that is a Trump store. In fact, that's what it's called. And it was stuffed with all kinds of Trump paraphernalia. Flags that say, don't tread on me. We've, of course, seen that before. There were T-shirts that said, if you don't like Trump, then you probably won't like me, and I'm okay with that. The other day, also in South Dakota, I saw a window sticker on a car with that same don't tread on me flag, except it said, don't tread on Trump. This is a really strong line of thinking among Trump supporters, and the Trump campaign and Trump himself are just more than happy to stoke that notion that they've got to fight back. And what we're seeing is defiance, right, is the idea that, yeah, they're out to get us, but we're not going to let them.
Presumably, you've been speaking to voters at every campaign stop of yours. What are you hearing from them?
So a real question is, what happens to these crucial voters in the middle, the ones who haven't made up their minds or are wavering? Because an awful lot of people, of course, have decided which side they're on. And it has been striking how many independents or what one might call moderate Republicans say, you know, Joe Biden's okay. I could never vote for Hillary Clinton. I didn't trust her. But Joe Biden, he's solid. And I think a key question is how people are going to make that decision, and so many of them are going to make it right at the end. I was talking with Bill Foster, who's a Democratic member of Congress from just outside of Chicago, and asking him how he thinks things will play out. And he's in a district that is not overwhelmingly Democratic. And he said, you know, I think an awful lot of people are going to go into the voting booth in November, and they're just going to say, I'm tired of the drama. I'm kind of worn out. Let's have a little bit of peace and quiet, which was clearly a theme that the Democrats were sounding last week at their convention.
There is this Nixonian strain in this campaign, but also our colleague Andrew Marantz pointed out in a NewYorker.com piece this morning, the allure of denialism among the media elite, as we are called. And he writes about Ronald Reagan, another notorious prevaricator, as drawing attention to manufactured crises while downplaying real ones, exploiting racism and jingoism. And, you know, obviously not with Trump's snarl, but with his, as Andrew puts it, his aw shucks grin. What do you think about that comparison?
I think we know an awful lot by now about how Donald Trump operates, and he's no Ronald Reagan. I think any reporter watching politics and thinking about 2016 knows not to make any premature predictions of how this is all going to go. But we know an awful lot about Donald Trump and what he's up to, and I don't think anybody's going to be taking him lightly.
Thank you so much, Peter. It's great talking to you.
Glad to be with you.
Peter Slevin, a contributing writer for The New Yorker, who's based in Chicago, teaches at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism, and he's the author of Michelle Obama, A Life. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on NewYorker.com. feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for NewYorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.